In Britain, every piece of legislation has to be signed off by the monarch before it can become law. Throughout her long reign, Queen Elizabeth II demanded emendations to 160 pieces of legislation before she was willing to sign. The emendations were essentially exemptions from these laws for her family and estates. These were laws to do with animal welfare, workers' rights. One piece of legislation, illegalizing discriminating against people in the workplace on the basis of race or ethnicity, became law only after Her Majesty had obtained an exemption for her family and estates. Crown powers extend to the police, being used to shut down investigations into elite crime. They extend to the secret services, giving them a remit that goes way beyond the powers of democratic government. All in all, the powers of the British Crown, notwithstanding democratic changes over 800 years, have proven persistent and far from ceremonial. In the 21st century, the hidden hand shaping public policy often belongs not to kings and queens, but to multinational corporations.
In Britain, in Australia, where I live, and in the USA and other countries besides, it's not uncommon for major corporations to make significant financial donations to both of the major parties in a general election, so that whichever party gains power, the same hidden hand will shape public policy. Now, that information is embedded in the stories of the Bible when we realize that we're reading stories of ancient colonization, when we realize that we're reading stories of paleocontact. But these insights are all lost when the memories of ET contact are translated out of public view, when those texts are changed into being texts about God. And one of the best examples of that comes in 1 Samuel chapter 8.
In 1 Samuel chapter 8, the tribes of Israel come together and tell Yahweh's representative that they no longer want direct rule by Yahweh. They want one of their own to govern them as a king.
Now, if we translate Yahweh as God or the Lord in the conventional way, that story is complete nonsense. Because why on earth would you think that you would get better advantage on the battlefield or in diplomacy if you have a human king rather than Almighty God? It doesn't make any sense at all. But the moment we recognize that some of the Yahweh stories fit absolutely in the world's canon of dragon narratives, it begins to make sense. Now, in my book, Echoes of Eden, I argue that embedded in the name of Yahweh, Tetragrammaton, is the evocation of a sound known to our ancestors. And it's a sound that repeats in the names of draconian entities told by indigenous cultures all around the world. Now, dragon narratives often take a familiar shape. It begins with our ancestors being governed over by merciless draconian entities, what we call dragons, who have no empathy towards the human beings. And the human's job is to keep the dragons supplied with gold, sheep, cows, and virgin girls. That's what the dragons like. They like beef, they like lamb, they like virgin girls, and they want a lot of gold. And the Yahweh narratives fit that pattern. There then comes a pivot where the people rebel against the dragons' autocratic, despotic leadership rooted in violence, because it will kill prodigious numbers of them through its fiery breath, through its prodigious size, so on and so forth. And the people say, no, enough already. They reach the point where the terror has been used so many times, it just loses its purchase. And the people begin to say, well, what can it do? It can only kill us. And when they reach that point, they realize that if they come together and speak with one voice and say, dragon, we will no longer serve you, what can the dragon do? Can't kill us all. Wouldn't have any servants. What would be the point? If we say with one voice, we will no longer serve you. The dragon will know its time has come. In my own lifetime, I've seen the power of human solidarity in that way. The falling of the Ceausescu regime in Romania, the falling of the first Marcos regime in the Philippines, the liberation of Nelson Mandela and the abolition of apartheid in South Africa, the destruction of the Berlin Wall. All this happened because of people finding each other, finding strength together, organizing and acting in solidarity. That is the lesson that flows from the world's canon of dragon narratives. And that's what we see being attempted in 1 Samuel 8. The people come together and say to their draconian entity, Yahweh, no more of your leadership, thank you very much. We'll have one of our own. Now, you might think that Yahweh's removal from the front bench would be sufficient to end his political career, but no. Despite having been gotten rid of as the ruler of the tribes of Israel, Yahweh remains the kingmaker. He decides who his own successor is going to be. He appoints King Saul. And then when he realizes that Saul isn't violent enough for his liking, he gets rid of him, tortures him until he commits suicide through mental illness, and appoints David, who is famously known as a person willing to use murder simply for his own pleasure to clear the path to a happy royal marriage. So David is there, a man after my own heart, says Yahweh. And as the stories of the kings and queens of Israel progress, we realize that if ever they depart from what Yahweh would want, punitive action will be taken. The moment David begins to question the wisdom of Yahweh's instructions to go to war, because David thinks, I only want to fight winnable wars, so he counts his army, 70,000 of David's own infantry are killed by Yahweh as a message to his king, you do not question orders. Now, when we translate that as a story of God, it leads to a God who can do the most monstrous things without any moral judgment. And our job is simply to take orders, whether they make sense or not. And we've seen in the 20th century where that leads to. It leads to Holocausts. And perhaps we're seeing something of where it leads to in the 21st century. It totally eviscerates our own sense of a moral compass. We are simply here to do what the advice of the politicians is. Well, our ancestors said that is draconian leadership. And our ancestors said there's a non-human layer to the governance of human beings, which is all that makes sense of many things that happen on planet Earth. When you translate these stories as God's stories, the message is your job is to do what God says, whether it makes sense or not, whether it seems moral or not. And I think that a veil falls from our eyes when we realize what we're actually reading is the violent story of colonization in the deep past, not stories about God. Our ancestors knew that there was a hidden hand behind the visible political power. They knew that you can change from one king to another king, but there is a power beyond that in the dark recesses of the corridors of power still calling the shots. And that until you realize there's this inscrutable, non-human layer to human governance, you won't understand what's happening at the visible level. You can replace a king with a president or a king with a prime minister, but it doesn't mean that the energy driving public policy or governing over your society has necessarily changed. Now, that wisdom is incredibly important, but it disappears the moment you translate Yahweh as God. Translated as God, and 1 Samuel 8 is just a story of rebellion and apostasy. Understand that Yahweh was one of many ET demographics governing over our ancestors in the deep past, and you realize our ancestors are equipping us for what that means, giving us a sense of how to overcome that and thrive on our own planet.
It was in the 6th century BCE that the Bible as we know it came into being. redactors gathered together the library of Hebrew texts and edited them to give the appearance of being a seamless story from start to finish of God. The change was made for ideological reasons, not reasons of translation. In the previous century, the King Josiah had cleaned up Jewish ritual practice to eradicate every ancestral memory of paleo contact.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalogue of material, along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.
In 381 AD, the Roman Emperor Theodosius took a decisive step to explain to all Roman citizens the world over which narratives were acceptable and which were not.
In 381 AD, what Emperor Theodosius did was to step into a theological debate. He really wanted to establish orthodoxy, move beyond this era of violent debates between factions within the church, and that really meant political factions within the empire as well. And he settled a theological debate that might sound like a really fine point, but what it did was have an immediate impact on all those groups that were supposedly on the fringe of Christianity, the Gnostic groups and the indigenous religions and priesthoods and sects that existed. It said that all that was fake news, and that the teaching of it was to be forbidden. And so that meant that the priesthoods of those other religions, the curators of those other texts, had to hide those stories. Texts literally had to be buried in the desert to keep them safe. Others would be shared secretly in underground meetings of esoteric societies. Other information would be hidden in plain sight, encoded into literature in the form of poetry and codes. In that way, these narratives were able to survive the orthodoxy of the empire, because the emperor wanted to be quite clear that it was the empire that determined what was true and what was false, what was news and what was fake news. And that power could not rest with unofficial indigenous priesthoods. There had to be a right and a wrong, and it had to be him who decided which was which. It's a pattern that continues through history. I've been a preacher for more than 30 years. I've preached on the book of Genesis in churches all around the world, and I've trained pastors in the principles of interpreting ancient texts. And so I've long known about these anomalies in the Hebrew scriptures that point to another, more ancient story. When you read them in parallel with the source narratives of ancient Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, Assyria, you realize these ancient stories are not about God. They are about other beings who've arrived on planet Earth from elsewhere and have had a hands-on involvement in our evolution as a species. These other entities in my book Escaping from Eden, I call them sky people. The glyph indicates the sky. They're people from the stars. That becomes clear as the story rolls on. They are people referred to as Anunnaki.